They breakfasted now off the remainder of Tom's provisions, meant for their supper, with additions that Tom had brought with him. It was not a large meal, considering hobbits and the circumstances, but they felt much better for it. While they were eating, Tom went up to the mound and looked through the treasures. Most of these he made into a pile that glistened and sparkled on the grass. He bade them lie there, free to all finders, birds, beasts, elves or men, and all kindly creatures, for so the spell of the mound should be broken and scattered, and no wight ever come back to it. He chose for himself from the pile a brooch set with blue stones, many shaded like flax flowers or the wings of blue butterflies. He looked long at it, as if stirred by some memory, shaking his head, and saying at last, "Here is a pretty toy for Tom and for his lady. Fair was she who long ago wore this on her shoulder. Goldberry shall wear it now, and we will not forget her." For each of the hobbits he chose a dagger, long, leaf-shaped and keen, of marvellous workmanship, damasked with serpent forms in red and gold. They gleamed as he drew them from their black sheaths, wrought of some strange metal, light and strong, and set with many fiery stones. Whether by some virtue in these sheaths, or because of the spell that lay on the mound, the blade seemed untouched by time, unrusted, sharp, glittering in the sun. "Old knives are long enough as swords for hobbit people," he said. "Sharp blades are good to have if shire folk go walking east, south, or far away into dark and danger." Then he told them that these blades were forged many long years ago by men of Westerness. They were foes of the Dark Lord, but they were overcome by the evil king of Carn Dûm in the land of Angmar. "Few now remember them," Tom murmured. "Yet still some go wandering, sons of forgotten kings walking in loneliness, guarding from evil things folk that are heedless." The hobbits did not understand his words, but as he spoke they had a vision, as it were, of a great expanse of years behind them, like a vast shadowy plain over which there strode shapes of men, tall and grim with bright swords, and last came one with a star on his brow. Then the vision faded, and they were back in the sunlit world. It was time to start again. They were ready, packing their bags and lading their ponies. Their new weapons they hung on their leather belts under their jackets, feeling them very awkward, and wondering if they would be of any use. Fighting had not before occurred to any of them as one of the adventures in which their flight would land them. At last they set off. They led their ponies down the hill, and then mounting they trotted quickly along the valley. They looked back and saw the top of the old mound on the hill, and from it the sunlight on the gold went up like a yellow flame. Then they turned the shoulder of the downs, and it was hidden from view. Though Frodo looked about him on every side, he saw no sign of the great stone standing like a gate. And before long they came to the northern gap and rode swiftly through, and the land fell away before them. It was a merry journey, with Tom Bombadil trotting gaily beside them, or before them, on Fatty Lumpkin, who could move much faster than his girth promised. Tom sang most of the time, but it was chiefly nonsense, or else perhaps a strange language unknown to the hobbits, an ancient language whose words were mainly those of wonder and delight. They went forward steadily, but they soon saw that the road was further away than they had imagined. Even without a fog, their sleep at midday would have prevented them from reaching it until after nightfall on the day before. The dark line they had seen was not a line of trees, but a line of bushes growing on the edge of a deep dike, with a steep wall on the further side. Tom said that it had once been the boundary of a kingdom, but a very long time ago. He seemed to remember something sad about it, and wouldn't say much. They climbed down and out of the dike, and through a gap in the wall, and then Tom turned due north. for they had been bearing somewhat to the west. The land was now open and fairly level, and they quickened their pace, but the sun was already sinking low when at last they saw a line of tall trees ahead, and they knew that they had come back to the road after many unexpected adventures. They galloped their ponies over the last furlongs and halted under the long shadows of the trees. They were on the top of a sloping bank, and the road, now dim as evening drew on, wound away below them. At this point it ran nearly from southwest to northeast, and on their right it fell quickly down into a wide hollow. It was rotted and bore many signs of the recent heavy rain. There were pools and potholes full of water. They rode down the bank and looked up and down. There was nothing to be seen. "Well, here we are again at last," said Frodo. "I suppose we haven't lost more than 2 days by my short cut through the forest, but perhaps the delay will prove useful. It may have put them off our trail." The others looked at him. The shadow of the fear of the Black Riders came suddenly over them again. Ever since they had entered the forest, they had thought chiefly of getting back to the road. Only now, when it lay beneath their feet, did they remember the danger which pursued them, and was more than likely to be lying in wait for them upon the road itself. They looked anxiously back towards the setting sun, but the road was brown and empty. "Do you think," asked Pippin hesitatingly, "do you think we may be pursued tonight?"
"No, I hope not tonight," answered Tom Bombadil, "nor perhaps the next day. But do not trust my guess, for I cannot tell for certain. Out east my knowledge fails. Tom is not master of riders from the Black Land far beyond his country."
All the same, the hobbits wished he was coming with them. They felt that he would know how to deal with black riders, if anyone did. They would soon now be going forward into lands wholly strange to them, and beyond all but the most vague and distant legends of the Shire, and in the gathering twilight they longed for home. A deep loneliness and sense of loss was on them. They stood silent, reluctant to make the final parting, and only slowly became aware that Tom was wishing them farewell, and telling them to have good heart and to ride on till dark without halting.
"Tom will give you good advice till this day is over. After that your own luck must go with you and guide you. 4 miles along the road you'll come upon a village, Bree under Bree Hill, with doors looking westward. There you'll find an old inn that is called the Prancing Pony. Barleyman Butterbur is the worthy keeper. There you can stay the night, and afterwards the morning will speed you upon your way. Be bold, but wary. Keep up your merry hearts, and ride to meet your fortune."
They begged him to come at least as far as the inn and drink once more with them, but he laughed and refused, saying,
"Tom's country ends here. He will not pass the borders. Tom has his house to mind, and Goldberry is waiting."
Then he turned, tossed up his hat, leapt on Lumpkin's back, and rode up over the bank and away, singing into the dusk. The hobbits climbed up and watched him until he was out of sight.
"I am sorry to take leave of Master Bombadil," said Sam. "He's a caution and no mistake. I reckon we may go a good deal further and see naught better nor queerer. But I won't deny I'll be glad to see this prancing pony he spoke of. I hope it'll be like the Green Dragon away back home. What sort of folk are they in Bree?"
"There are hobbits in Bree," said Merry, "as well as big folk. I dare say it'll be home-like enough. The pony is a good inn by all accounts. My people ride out there now and again."
"It may be all we could wish," said Frodo, "but it's outside the Shire all the same. Don't make yourselves too much at home. Please remember, all of you, that the name of Baggins must not be mentioned. I am Mr. Underhill, if any name must be given."
They now mounted their ponies and rode off silently into the evening. Darkness came down quickly, as they plodded slowly downhill and up again, until at last they saw lights twinkling some distance ahead. Before them rose Bree Hill, barring the way, a dark mass against misty stars, and under its western flank nestled a large village. Towards it they now hurried, desiring only to find a fire and a door between them and the night. Chapter 9. At the Sign of the Prancing Pony. Bree was the chief village of the Breeland, a small inhabited region like an island in the empty lands round about. Besides Bree itself, there was Staddle on the other side of the hill, Coombe in a deep valley a little further eastward, and Archet on the edge of the Chetwood. Lying round Bree Hill and the villages was a small country of fields and tamed woodland only a few miles broad. The men of Bree were brown-haired, broad and rather short, cheerful and independent. They belonged to nobody but themselves, but they were more friendly and familiar with hobbits, dwarves, elves, and other inhabitants of the world about them than was or is usual with big people. According to their own tales, they were the original inhabitants, and were the descendants of the first men that ever wandered into the west of the middle world. Few had survived the turmoils of the elder days, but when the kings returned again over the great sea, they had found the Bree men still there, and they were still there now, when the memory of the old kings had faded into the grass. In those days no other men had settled dwellings so far west, or within 100 leagues of the Shire. But in the wild lands beyond Bree there were mysterious wanderers. The Bree folk called them rangers, and knew nothing of their origin. They were taller and darker than the men of Bree, and were believed to have strange powers of sight and hearing, and to understand the languages of beasts and birds. They roamed at will southwards, and eastwards even as far as the Misty Mountains, but they were now few and rarely seen. When they appeared they brought news from afar, and told strange forgotten tales which were eagerly listened to. But the Bree folk did not make friends of them. There were also many families of hobbits in the Bree land, and they claimed to be the oldest settlement of hobbits in the world, one that was founded long before even the Brandywine was crossed and the Shire colonized. They lived mostly in Staddle, though there were some in Bree itself, especially on the higher slopes of the hill, above the houses of the men. The big folk and the little folk, as they called one another, were on friendly terms, minding their own affairs in their own ways, but both rightly regarding themselves as necessary parts of the Bree folk. Nowhere else in the world was this peculiar but excellent arrangement to be found. The Bree folk, big and little, didn't themselves travel much, and the affairs of the four villages were their chief concern. Occasionally the hobbits of Bree went as far as Buckland, or the East Farthing, but though their little land was not much farther than a day's riding east of the Brandywine Bridge, the hobbits of the Shire now seldom visited it. An occasional Bucklander, or adventurous Took, would come out to the inn for a night or two, but even that was becoming less and less usual. The Shire hobbits referred to those of Bree, and to any others that lived beyond the borders, as outsiders, and took very little interest in them, considering them dull and uncouth.